Carrie's Couch.
On Carrie's Couch today, I am really excited because I got this book. It's not inside, it's on top. Gave it a read and was so just incredibly excited to be able to speak to this author. It is a South African woman doing remarkable work with her words, and it is Nostalgia 101. And on Carrie's Couch today, I welcome the wonderful Kanya Mchali. Hello, Kanya.
Hi, Carrie. Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for being on Carrie's Couch. Before we even get to the book, let's get to know a little bit about the woman behind this book. Kanya, where were you born? Kind of where did you grow up?
I was born in Johannesburg, and I grew up in various areas of Johannesburg. So I was born in Katlehong and stayed there for a bit, and then moved to Soweto, and then moved to Midrand, and kind of just hovered in different areas. But yeah, I'm mainly Joburg based.
And the idea of writing, is that something that you've always just been passionate about? Because I mean, you are a journalist and you've got your MA. Did you plan on writing this book, or is it something that came to you in the throes of lockdown, or what happened here?
So I have been writing for some time, but I started doing it professionally when I decided to do my MA, which was in 2015. And then the idea for the book, I'd had it for some time. I had wanted to use TV adverts as a way to discuss our very recent history as South Africans. And it just so happened that in 2019, I was approached by an editor at Tafelberg, which is my publisher, who asked if I would be interested in writing a book. And so I just pitched this idea to her, not thinking that it would actually go through. And it got commissioned, and I began writing it during lockdown, which was really difficult and wouldn't advise at all.
Yeah, I can imagine.
That's kind of how it came about.
Well, this is the thing, is that some people just baked their way to near obesity over lockdown. You wrote a book. Again, before we even get to the contents of the book, the actual writing of a book, like, where does one start? I mean, you're saying someone approached you and said, would you write this? Lockdown kind of helped, I guess, because there wasn't much else you could do. But in your process, where does the book begin? Is it a journal of notes? Is it you just sit at the computer and go, kind of like Sex in the City-esque? How does it happen?
Well, first, I procrastinated a lot.
Good. Yeah.
Great start. Because usually, you know, as much as lockdown did help remove the distractions, it was also difficult because it shut down a lot of avenues that I was hoping to take. So I did a lot, or I was planning on doing a lot of in-person reporting. You know, I had this vision of meeting all the sources and, you know, whipping out my tape recorder and my notebook, but I never got the chance to do that. Everything was conducted online. And then there was the case of accessing, you know, information, which was difficult because sometimes libraries would be shut down, or they'd be only be open on certain days, and I couldn't speak to certain businesses because they'd gone into business rescue. So it really complicated the reporting and research side of things. But I tried to really find interesting ways of getting around that. So whether it was taking a different approach to writing a piece, you know, writing from a first person perspective, or really just making it more observation based. Those were the ways in which I tried to write around the problems. But yeah, a lot of note taking, a lot of just really trying to find really inexpensive ways of accessing archives, because that was also very difficult. Usually advertisers get rid of their archives, or sometimes businesses want to charge you a hefty amount to access their archives. So yeah, it was difficult, but I tried to find a way to get the book out.
So Kanya, you were obviously writing during lockdown. I know that you got your Bachelor of Law, your LLB honours from the University of Edinburgh. I know that you did your MA in Cultural Reporting and Criticism at New York University. Where were you for lockdown?
I was here. I've been in
home.
Yeah, I've been in South Africa for 3 years now, about 3 years now. So I was here and I was writing from home. I was fortunate enough that my 9-to-5 allowed me to work from home. So it really made the process easy, because if there was a day, for example, where I had, you know, 2 hours to kill during work, I would spend it on the book. But it also meant that I spent a lot of time, like, not getting enough sleep, because because, you know, there were days where work was incredibly hectic and I had to work overtime, which then meant working, you know, really late into the night, if not early morning. So I did most of the writing here.
I was actually going to ask you, so, you know, if your work allowed for you to do this, when you're writing a book and you're writing it for fun and you really want to get it out there, that's one thing. But when someone's commissioned it and you know you've got deadlines, did it still feel like work while you were writing, or did you still have that excitement of the new writer who was getting this book written? Or did it sometimes those days where like, oh man, I've got to get my 2 hours of writing in?
So interestingly, it's so funny because I think my relationship to writing has changed over the years. Like I found that the more pieces that I had published, the less fun writing became, because it started to feel like a job. And that's not a bad thing, because I think it's mostly the pressure that gets to you. And I still get that joy when I get a sentence right, or I nail an observation, or, you know, the passages are just flowing. But it felt like a huge amount of pressure, and it was incredibly stressful. And I legitimately, throughout every single step of the way, felt like I was not going to produce this book. Like, really? There were so many times where I was speaking to my editor and I just wanted to say, like, look, I can't do this. I cannot do this, because it really felt impossible and it was really stressful and it just not fun in the most dire way. And that isn't to say that I, you know, had a terrible time throughout.
It's just being honest. Yeah,
true. Like, and the pressure of failing, the pressure of not meeting people's expectations, knowing that, you know, there's so many people involved in writing a book, people who depend on you getting the manuscript through so they can get, you know, a check. That's very, very, very hectic. So it was stressful, but I'm really glad I managed to do it, because it's a skill that I picked up. And I think I learned, you know, the value of really being disciplined with my time and seeing something through to completion.
Well, I know a lot of work went into the back of the book. I think there's about 20 pages of references and sources. I mean, you really had to scour to find this information. And I mean, the moment that last word was written, you had done your final draft and it had come back and your editor had said, we're good to go. What was that feeling for you?
Oh, you know, it's like you never feel a sense of relief. Well, maybe this is just a personal thing. Maybe this is just how I tick, but I never felt a sense of relief. I always felt on edge, because given how lockdown went and given how the writing process was, it was so completely different to how I wanted it to go. I always felt like I could have done a better draft. I could have fixed this. I could have fixed that. I kept stressing until the 11th hour. Like, there was not a moment that I felt, you know, and I think that's really just the business of writing. You never feel like you've submitted your best work. You always feel like you could improve, you could get better. And sometimes that can be productive, because it means you're not being complacent. But then on the other hand, it can be toxic, because it means you're never satisfied. Yeah. And it means that you sometimes get into a habit of beating yourself up, which can then lead to you not writing anything, because you're too scared to fail.
Too hard on yourself.
Exactly. Yeah. But it's about achieving the balance. So there was, you know, I guess when I saw my book, you know, published and in a store, I did feel that sense of pride and relief, and kind of, you know, I patted myself on the back because I actually finished something. But yeah, it's about getting that balance right, because I think it's healthy to have that sense of not getting something right and wanting to get something right. But then you also can't be too hard on yourself, because you might not write anything really.
But that's a massive life lesson for you, and I think for anyone listening, Kanya, because, you know, whether you're a mom or a partner or anywhere, there's always that feeling of, am I doing enough? Am I good enough? And I think one of the biggest lessons is that we have to know that if your intention at the time is good and you're doing the best you can, I'm sure maybe in 5-10 years, you might look back and say, oh, I would have phrased that differently. But at the time, you put in your everything. And from someone who I'm by no means a critic, but I enjoy reading, I thoroughly enjoyed this book, thoroughly enjoyed it. It felt like, and I think you'll know what I mean. It felt like you transported me back to my youth in a way that I didn't even realize I was there for it. So like you were holding my hand, reminding me of these adverts, which I never realized as well what a huge part of our lives the adverts are. I mean, these songs that I reminded of, and I still had all the lyrics in my head. I could see the house I was living in with my parents. I could just imagine myself at that time. And that's why I've got Kanya with me today. Kanya's the author of It's Not Inside, It's On Top, Memorable Moments in South African Advertising. And even though that is the name of the book, and It's Not Inside, It's On Top, and there's only one small chapter. So this advertising, the adverts, the looking at the South African adverts, why is this where you chose to go?
You know, as you mentioned before, I think what interests me about TV adverts and these particular TV adverts that I chose is that they really occupied a particular place in our history. And I think if you look at South Africa, we got television, you know, comparatively late.
Yes.
If you look at the rest of the world. And so I think, you know, there was a way in which we watched adverts that, or let me put it this way, I think we watched adverts very closely, and I think adverts occupied a certain place in our everyday lives because this experience of watching television was so new. And I think because it was such a new medium, people were experimenting and doing creative things, which resulted in better ads. And like you mentioned, these adverts existed in tandem with our everyday lives, you know? So I thought this is an opportunity for me to use nostalgia, something that people love to indulge in, to kind of tell a story about our history, to shed light on things that we may not have thought about, to really delve into the social aspects of our country, the cultural aspects, the political aspects, in a way that felt accessible, but also critical. I really feel like mass media tells a lot of stories about who we were, you know, how we saw ourselves as a country, you know, our national identity. It's a really interesting way to gauge exactly where we happen to be as a country. So, yeah, I thought it was a very interesting way to delve into our history.
Well, this is the thing, Kanya, because I was born in the 80s, so I was very much around for apartheid. That said, I was young, you know, so I didn't understand what was going on. But now I totally do have memories of the first person of color in my school and my gogo, you know, not being able to come to the park with me. And I didn't understand. Looking at some of the ads, and as you described them, I mean, from the, I think it's right in the front is the VW ad in Uitenhage. I was quite shocked and appalled, and I don't want to give everything away because I really feel like everyone needs to read this book. It's Not Inside, It's On Top, Memorable Moments in South African Advertising. That I kind of feel a little bit like the wool has been pulled over my eyes. You know, these moments I just saw as quirky, funny. Was it the Vodacom guy with the Yebo Gogo? All of these that were just fun. And then when reading your take on these and understanding a little bit more behind it, I'm almost a little bit embarrassed. Am I reading it wrong?
I mean, I think what I wanted to do was complicate nostalgia. I think it's easy to sort of be embarrassed about not seeing things in a particular way. But, you know, we also have to understand the country was relatively new. Or when the VW ad came out, for example, there was a sense of wanting to be ahead of the curve, you know, to anticipate the changes that were inevitable at the time. So in some ways, it was impossible to see exactly what was happening behind the scenes. As you mentioned, I don't want to give anything away, but with the VW ad, for example, it's difficult to sort of see that the ad that they produced was co-opting some of the protests that were happening at the Uitenhage plant.
Yeah.
So you won't know all those things by watching the ad, which is why I love cultural criticism and I love being able to pick these adverts apart, because it offers an opportunity, not just for the reader, but for me to disrupt some of the things that I had taken for granted, these narratives or these ideas that I assumed were, you know, just a given. I had to reconsider even as I was writing the book. So, you know, it's a really wonderful process where you kind of get to really challenge yourself and things that you thought through adverts that you liked or you thought were saying something, when in actual fact they're saying something else.
Yeah. And after doing all of this work, just some like kind of maybe quick questions, you don't have to go into it so much. Which ad do you love now the most out of the ones that you spoke about? Which is the one that you're, after unpacking it and kind of going into the background and understanding why it was done the way it was done, which is the ad now that goes top of your list?
I have to say the Sprite Zero ad is my favorite ad. Because I absolutely love Joelle Kayembe, who's the model who starred in that ad. I don't know if I have time to explain it, but it's essentially an ad where the woman has a boyfriend who's hooting at her and she's getting dressed for dates. And eventually she gets so tired of his nonsense that she steps out in her lingerie.
Yes, I remember that so well.
Yeah. And I suppose what interests me about that ad is the fact that it's quite risque. And South Africa tends to be relatively conservative when it comes to those things. And yet it stood the test of time and it's still very popular even to this day. And I even remember that it was constantly on air for a number of years.
Yeah.
I just thought the execution of the ad was funny and great. I really thought that Joelle Kayembe nailed the part and her facials were fantastic. And she really understood exactly who this woman was.
Mm.
And it was cheeky and irreverent and really told a story within a couple of seconds. And what interests me about that ad is that I never ever thought, oh my goodness, what is she going to do now that she's in the car in the lingerie? I never thought beyond that point. I was just so...
What engine will sell her pants?
Exactly. Like I thought, is she going to go up and get clothes? I never ever thought about that. And that really does speak to the brilliance of that ad and knowing when to kind of stop and just how to get the details right. It's really arguably one of my favorite ads. And it was one of my favorite chapters to write because I really like Joelle Kayembe, and she was a very interesting person, and you know the place that she occupied during the 2000s always intrigued me. So it was really lovely to get to talk to her about that ad and her career as a model.
You know, as you were talking now, bringing up the Sprite Zero ad, and you just spoke about how it was quite hectic to have a woman come out in lingerie and, you know, South Africa, and we are quite conservative. And I mean, again, it's hard not to give away too much from the book, but I have to just mention certain Nando's ads. I mean, we don't have to mention by name, but I mean, Nando's is known for kind of crossing the line. After writing this book, do you think that in South Africa we should allow our advertisers more freedom to kind of be on the line, or do you think we have a right to still be quite uptight? We're still a relatively new democracy that's got a lot of pain.
True. You know, I think it's a balance. It really is a balance, because oftentimes some of the best ads that we have, in my view, know how to toe the line. They know how to poke fun at things that are slightly painful or slightly tricky to navigate. Right, tricky to navigate without causing offense. But again, it's very difficult because we do have our history. We do have divisions in this country that shouldn't be exploited because they haven't been repaired. So, you know, it really does require that a balance be struck, and it really does require people to be sensitive to people's pain and people's sort of refusal to have certain things mined for laughs, because we aren't all the way there. We still are a relatively new democracy, and we still haven't overcome some of these hurdles and these obstacles. And so it really is a question of trying to kind of strike the balance right, in my view.
And then when you were going through all these old school ads, was there one in particular that stood out to you that made you go, oh, whoa, just like, I did not know that, or that really kind of blew your mind in one way or another?
I have to say the VW ad, I know we've spoken about this, but just the what was happening in the back end surprised me, and the fact that it wasn't as straightforward as I anticipated it would be. The Castle ads and how Castle evolved as a brand.
Oh yes, and the Toto Africa. I also was like yesterday years old when I knew that when I found out Toto wasn't from Africa.
Exactly. No, I am with you, and I'm so glad that you actually said that, because I felt so embarrassed that
No. There's a few of us,
song.
Even the DJs. I promise.
Right.
Like, bless the rains in Africa. We also were like, obviously, these guys must be from Claremont or something. You know.
Yeah, and also, you know, that advert, you know, kind of That particular song accompanied an advert that was very patriotic. So it was very easy for me to make that connection.
All of us.
So I was very, right. So I was very surprised to have seen that, you know, Castle Lager ads evolved so much. Like, they changed so much, and they really attempted to speak to certain demographics and constituencies in this country. That really took me by surprise, especially seeing how Castle changed and attempted to speak to Black youth. Like, again, I saw this happen. I saw the show that came out, Castle One, for example, and I saw all these changes, and I never really thought, okay, they're doing this because they're trying to reject an image that was once progressive but now seems kind of unrelatable to a certain group of South Africans. So those were the two ads that, I guess it's not so much the ads that took me by surprise, but it was the back end, what was happening behind the scenes that I found interesting.
When you wrote there about, especially with the Uitenhage situation, that those workers, actually the factory was shut down for the day and they were just there for their normal work day and were used, where these days, you know, you go and there's, you get cast and you get a day fee, and if your face is in for a certain amount, then you get a usage fee, and it's this money and that money, and these guys were literally just there. I was like, what is even happening? As Coconut Curls would say, think about it, guys. Something was
think
awesome.
About it,
guys. Think about it, guys. Do you think going forward that we will ever have TV advertising like we did, or as we move more into a digital age, that TV advertising is a thing of the past?
You know, it's interesting because in South Africa, as much as, you know, the digital frontier is here, and that's quite literally where a lot of advertising is migrating, a lot of people still watch television and still listen to radio. So I can't exactly say that those forms of advertising are obsolete, but I don't think that we will have the same relationship with ads that we once had, because things have changed. The way we watch television has changed. There's so many distractions. There's so many things competing for our attention. Ads have become irritants.
Yeah. I'll fast forward if there's an ad on, you know, you're watching something. If you don't wait for it to be on either Catch Up or Netflix or Showmax or wherever you consume, even YouTube, you wait for that 5, 4, 3, 2, 1 next. I don't know the last time I sat and watched a TV ad.
Exactly. Like, we don't watch ads the same way we do. Even if you don't fast forward, you just sort of block it out.
Yeah.
So I don't necessarily think that, I don't think that ads have the potential to resonate the way they used to, because our relationship to television has changed dramatically. And it's a very tough position to be in, because people don't like ads. Ads are very irritating. And in some ways, I think we've found the ability to not watch them, and to an extent, ads don't necessarily have the same sort of power that they used to. They don't seem to grab our attention the way they used to. So it's a really tricky situation, I guess. And I think for a while people have said the 30-second ad, the 60-second ad is dead. There's no reason to invest in them. But then you have a country that mainly watches television and listens to radio to kind as a medium. So how do you then balance that? It's a very difficult question to sort of answer. And I think it's a challenge for advertisers right now.
And I also feel for advertisers in general, you know, even from a radio perspective, if, for example, let's say we're in radio in Australia, you're speaking to a majority white, majority culturally the same, majority certain class, that's your audience. When we're working in South Africa, you're talking to different LSMs, so different earning categories. You're talking to various cultures, you're talking to different languages, and obviously then different races as well. Do you think that makes it easier to do advertising here because you've got so much option, or does it actually make it a lot harder because every single corner you walk into, someone's offended?
It's very hard. You know, South Africa is a country of many countries. You know, there are 5 countries in one. It's just so incredibly different given where you go. So it's difficult to create advertising that appeals to people, because certain people don't see themselves in certain ads. And, you know, it really is a question of attempting to really speak to something that all South Africans resonate with. But how do you do that, given our history, given, you know, the way geographically people are placed, their class positions? It's incredibly difficult. So it's something that I think, you know, for example, in the 90s, there were complaints from Black advertisers that advertising was too segregated, that people would make different ads for different demographics, and that was seen as racist. But then, you know, it's difficult to achieve that balance where you produce something that speaks to all South Africans, 100%. Because we're completely different and our life experiences are vastly different. So it's not easy, and I don't even think I have the solution or can even imagine how to get around that, because this country is a country of multiple countries, multiple experiences that is difficult to kind of nail in a 30-second or 60-second ad.
It's impossible, I'd say.
Yeah.
So again, not giving anything away. And when you listening right now have got your copy of It's Not Inside, It's On Top by Kanya Mtshali, and you get to the section about that Cremora ad, I want you to think of me, because I am completely blown away by your story about the Cremora ad and what went down with that. I'm not going to go into it. One must go and read it themselves. But I have to ask you, since publishing the book, have you had any more feedback on who actually did author that line or say that? Because I know in the book you do mention that it could have been this, I think it was a German guy or a Swiss guy that might have said it. But it seemed like maybe we weren't 100% sure.
No, you know, it's interesting because I think I went through this process where I was getting different answers as to who authored this ad. And Andy Rice, who's a famous critic, advertising critic, kind of confirmed that the person who I said was responsible for authoring this particular ad and the agency that I cited as being responsible for the ad was more or less correct. But even he had to do the research, which is incredible because Andy Rice is so knowledgeable about the field. So yeah, it's an interesting one, because even at my book launch, there was somebody who suggested that this ad was actually kind of flighted in America, like the idea came from America. And I thought, oh, that's interesting. I didn't really pick up on that in my research, but I had never seen that confirmed through what I saw as I was writing the book. So it was really funny how this ad that has endured the ages and still remains, you know, very resonant in this country. We still don't know who actually came up with it. It interested me that for certain ads, like, we just don't know who came up with it, because sometimes the archives don't really tell the full story, or there's multiple different accounts, or the people who were involved with the ad have passed away. It's a really it's an interesting one.
Well, when we do finally figure it out, give that man a bells. See what I did there. Well, Kanya, I'm so grateful that you came and joined me on Kiri's Couch. Really, such a pleasure and such a lovely trip down memory lane, and very informative. I have been educated. It's Not Inside, It's On Top, Memorable Moments in South African Advertising by Kanya Mtshali. Where can we find your book?
Exclusive books mainly. But I've been told that there are some copies at CNA.
Brilliant. And online anywhere?
You can get it via Kindle.
All right. Excellent. Kanya, thank you again so much. And we look forward to your next book. You let us know when you decide to put yourself through all that pain again. Okay.
Oh my goodness. I will do. But thank you so much for having me, Kiri.
Thank you so much, Kanya.